Are you ready for the conscience of psychiatry? For the best-selling author of Talking Back to Prozac, Medication Madness, and now Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, it's the Dr. Peter Bregan Hour with guests unafraid to speak the truth about psychiatry and psychology and about how you can make the most of your own life.
And this is Dr. Peter Bregan. And one of the really wonderful, wonderful things about having a radio show is that I get to reacquaint with old, old friends by inviting them onto the show. And I want to start today by doing something I've not done before on air. I'm going to read a little bit from one of my books. It's from Toxic Psychiatry, back in 1991. And it's about my guest. And the section is about the survivor's fight back. And this is some of what I wrote about my guest. Most dramatically, one man who was electroshocked at the age of 6 managed for a few brief days to halt the use of shock in one of America's cities. Ted Chabosinski was a shy child genius growing up in a poor and dysfunctional family when a social worker removed him from his home and placed him in the psychiatric system. Soon he was subjected to shock treatment at the hands of one of the most famous, should be infamous, child psychiatrists of all time, Loretta Bender. That was at Bellevue, by the way. Young Chabosinski was so confused and terrorized by the treatment that he inadvertently helped to maintain his long odyssey within the state mental hospital system. When doctors asked the little boy, "Do you hear voices?" he would dutifully reply, "Yes," hoping to please his captors and to avoid further shock. After being discharged from Rockland State in his teens, it took Chabosinski several years to build a life for himself. In 1971, like so many other survivors, he joined the newly burgeoning ex-inmate movement and received enormous moral support from it. Eventually, he went to law school and is now a practicing attorney and patient rights advocate. In 1982, this is the final thought about Ted. In 1982, before gaining his law degree, Chabosinski organized what eventually became the Berkeley Ban, a citizen movement aimed at stopping electroshock in Berkeley and specifically at Herrick Hospital, a general hospital with a psychiatric ward. An overwhelming victory was won at the polls as the people of Berkeley voted yes on a proposition to say no to shock treatment. But within a few weeks, the American Psychiatric Association had obtained a court order overturning the vote. Eventually, the case was won by organized psychiatry. But for 41 days in the winter of 1982, there was a power outage at Herrick. And with that, I introduce my marvelous guest, Ted Chabosinski. Hi, Ted.
Hello, Peter. Thank you for inviting me.
Did you remember that I wrote about you in Toxic Psychiatry?
I believe I saw that piece, yeah. And maybe we can just go right into something that I wanted to talk about here, because I think my introduction really leads up to it, if that's all right with you.
Sure.
Well, I think what's going on now with children is even worse than what was done to me. You have, well, let's name a name here. You have somebody who's taken Dr. Bender's place as perhaps an even more evil doctor, and that is Dr. Joseph Biederman of Harvard. He more or less invented the diagnosis of childhood bipolar, just as Dr. Bender invented the diagnosis of childhood schizophrenia so she could shock me and hundreds of other children. But now the big thing is drugs, and Dr. Biederman was found out to have taken at least almost $4 million from drug companies, which he did not report on his conflict of interest forms at Harvard as he kept raking in the money from the drug companies. So what's happened is he's invented this diagnosis of childhood bipolar. And as a result of all the other drugging of children, I believe the figure is something like 10% of kids now are getting these amphetamine-like drugs for this invented disease named, what's it?
Well, ADHD deficit, and then childhood bipolar disorder.
Right, but we're going, first we start with putting them on the speed. And
right.
Then what seems to happen is, apparently according to Bob Whitaker, whose excellent book, Anatomy of an Epidemic, talks about this, apparently these drugs kids get for ADHD, or they get the SSRI drugs, and these drugs apparently damage the ability of the brain to regulate mood. So you now have an incredible figure, which I have to laugh, there was some media thing about it, but they didn't, you couldn't even deal with the numbers. You have a 4,000% increase in people diagnosed with bipolar disorder. Now, some of that is just diagnosis because, you know, it's just a label because Dr. Biederman is vigorously promoting this, but some of it apparently is real. But whether it's real or a label, you now have at least hundreds of thousands of kids, and maybe as many as a million, they're on antipsychotics now because they label with bipolar disorder. Now, let's go back to Dr. Biederman's money. He didn't report this. One of the things he didn't report is that he solicited $750,000 from Johnson & Johnson, the makers of Risperdal. He wanted them to give the money to this research foundation he was starting. And in his letter soliciting the money, he said, if you make this contribution, I'll see to it that my research shows that Risperdal is beneficial for children. How's that for science, eh? Science? No, it's not science. He's taking a bribe to promote the drug company's products, and this is not just a matter of swindling people out of money. This is a matter of lives destroyed. Hundreds of thousands, maybe as many as a million children having their lives destroyed by these antipsychotic drugs that are the non-drug company research shows that these drugs shrink the brain. In fact, I should actually say that one of the biggest research studies about this shrinking the brain was actually done by a doctor who's very pro-drug, Nancy Andreessen, who should get some credit that she finally reported her results after 2 years. So this is not just, people like me who are angry at psychiatry. This is some solid research that's been done. So the drugs shrink the brain, and they certainly numb out these children, so they don't experience childhood. They're just kind of, you know, out of it. You're basically taking away their childhood, just like mine was taken away. Now, I'm sitting here talking very articulately, I suppose, and I became a lawyer and all that, and I was able to reclaim my life as much as one can. But I didn't get drugged, you see. I got shock treatment, and that sounds horrible, and it was horrible. But I didn't get drugged, and the reason I didn't get drugged, this was so long ago, they didn't have these drugs then. Lucky me, huh? And just before I left Rockland State Hospital in 1954, they were just starting to give these drugs to every state hospital inmate, and I just escaped. And that's why I was able to go on with my life. But if I had spent my entire childhood on these drugs, I wouldn't be sitting here now talking over the radio. I probably wouldn't be alive, because other research not sponsored by the drug company shows that people long-term on these drugs, they die 15 to 25 years earlier than the general population. I'm going to pause for breath here, Peter, and let you say something. I know you've written about all this stuff. I think there's nothing about the abuses of psychiatry that you haven't dealt with, and I really thank you for that. So I'm going to give everybody a break and stop talking for a minute.
Thank you, Ted. Yeah. Yes, I think I was the first person to blow the whistle on Biederman in the medical psychiatric literature, and on his taking money from the drug companies. And then, of course, there was the congressional investigation, which turned up all these huge amounts of money that he was taking. And yeah, what does happen to the children is that first they put on stimulants. Stimulants can cause manic behavior, manic-like behavior, agitation, anxiety, huge amount of upset, insomnia, hyperactivity, psychosis. And then often, as the kids get more agitated, they're put on perhaps a benzo to get them to sleep, or an antihypertensive drug that's sedating to get them to sleep. And eventually they get put on an antidepressant, because stimulants overall suppress spontaneous behavior. So they look depressed, they get on the stimulants. On the antidepressants. The antidepressants make kids very crazy. We have one study after another showing 40, 50, 60% of children on antidepressants develop anger and outrage and some degree of mania. So then they end up diagnosed bipolar. So as you were saying, there's these two routes that occur. One is the drugs making the children disturbed, and then they get called bipolar and put on the antipsychotic drugs. And the other route is just simply, under Biederman's influence, the children end up with temper tantrums. They're undisciplined, or they're having conflicts at home, and the temper tantrum is called childhood bipolar disorder. Most of the kids and young adults that I see in my practice who have been labeled with bipolar disorder, maybe 9 out of 10, had something like a manic-like episode directly related to finally being put on antidepressants. And instead of the doctor saying to mom and dad, "I'm so sorry I made your child crazy with these drugs," the doctor proudly says, we uncovered the bipolar tendency in your child. Now we have to treat it."
Oh, yes.
Positively evil.
Oh, yes. What you said was sort of done to me, and Dr. Bender wrote an article some years later trying to deal with the fact that many of the kids that got shock treatment, who didn't really seem that sick, because I certainly wasn't, she said, well, the reason for that is that the shock treatment uncovered the underlying psychosis. She said that This is really incredible, but she said that, neurotic children appear to be upset, but if a child is psychotic, schizophrenic, they appear normal, but this is a symptom of their schizophrenia. And the shock treatment brings out the underlying sickness so that can then be treated. Now, if that sounds like utter nonsense to our listeners, it is utter nonsense, but psychiatrists talk this way. That kind of psychiatrist talks that way all the time. And I also want to say, we're talking something more than a scandal. I mean, don't you think, I think the listener should realize that we're not talking about some little, we're not talking about an upset stomach from aspirin here. We're talking about ruined lives. We're talking about a crime against humanity. That's really what it is. And I know people recoil from that. It's so extreme, they say, blah, blah, blah. Well, I don't think it's an extreme description of what these people do. These people, especially Biederman, he's already done enough. He's committed some very obvious crimes. I mean, just not reporting that stuff to the feds is a crime. But nobody lifts a finger. When it turned out that he lied to Harvard, all Harvard did, they slapped him on the wrist. They said, well, you can't participate in any research for a year. But, these places all want that money. They want money coming in for research centers, and they don't really care what kind of research is done, because, like a lot of other aspects of society, everybody has their own little bureaucratic empire. So here you have a man that really ought to be in prison for the rest of his life, and instead he's running around training other psychiatrists to do this. And I think people should realize also, we're talking about kids getting diagnosed here. We're not talking about, at the beginning anyway, talking about children who are acting really weird. We're talking about kids that the teacher doesn't want to deal with, We're frequently talking about the most creative children, the brightest children who, get bored in class. And what we're doing is we're wiping out some of the best. These kids could make a great contribution to society. We're really changing American society with this. Our culture is really being changed by what the psychiatrists are doing. We're ruining the lives of hundreds of thousands of children. We now have, what's the figure? You know better than I do, Peter. 1 out of 5 or 1 out of 6 Americans are now taking a psychiatric drug. and we talk, you know, jokingly about how, oh well, if Einstein or Leonardo da Vinci or whoever was alive today, they would put on drugs. Ha 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 ha, we say, but the fact is that's exactly what's going to happen. You know, for instance, one of my favorite historical figures in the United in America, President Lincoln, he was known to have spells of feeling very down. He would have been put on heavy duty psychiatric drugs now, and he wouldn't have been able to make any contribution to American society. So we're drugging ourselves to literally to death here. And it's so many people are on these drugs now. For instance, the antidepressants, for instance, a very interesting book just came out. I forget the exact title. It's something like Growing Up on Zoloft. And it's by a young woman who literally did that from her early teens. She was on an antidepressant, and she talks about, you know, all the things she's lost in her life. There's another young woman who's active in our movement, Laura Delano, who was very active, as I say, and she also had the same experience. You don't even know who you are with these psychiatric drugs. There's another study by some therapist, that, again, Peter, you probably could name the name, and they say basically what they're seeing with teenagers that have been on these drugs for a while is that they don't relate like ordinary adolescents. They're not interested in dating. They're not interested in sex. They're not interested in having any kind of relationships with the other sex. What is this going to do to our society if we let this continue? And getting away from children, people should also realize that, you know, there's been some flurry of attention to the fifth edition of the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, which is the Bible for diagnoses. And basically, if you look at the sort of nonsense they have in there, I'd say something like 80% of the people in this country could get a diagnosis of mental illness. Certainly for children, it's just really scary. If your kid talks back, they have oppositional defiant disorder. If your kid, doesn't pay attention to the teacher, we already know about that. It's ADHD. If the two-year-old has a temper tantrum, they were calling it bipolar, but there was so much of an uproar, and now they're calling it dysphoric mood regulation, some nonsense like that, which amounts to the same thing, because it leads to the same treatment. Antipsychotic drugs. Antipsychotic drugs to a two-year-old that has a tantrum. I was at a recent meeting, it was a demonstration against the American Psychiatric Association in Philadelphia in May, and some very courageous psychologist said, you know, she was talking about this business of two-year-olds who have tantrums or mentally ill, and she said, if I saw a two-year-old that didn't have a tantrum, I'd be worried about him. So what people should realize is that their kids can be labeled and given these heavy-duty drugs, and these drugs are not harmless. They're not harmless whatsoever. There's plenty of, again, I say, non-drug company-sponsored research. All the research sponsored by the drug companies, surprise, surprise, it always shows how wonderful these drugs are. But when you have research done that isn't paid for by the drug companies, you have a very different picture. And so people should realize they can get this. They can get labeled. There's just no end to these labels. No end. If you spend too much time on the Internet, you have a mental illness. How much time, I'm going to ask my viewers or my listeners, the listeners here, how much time do you spend on the Internet? And there's another one that I think is really horrible. You now have, I won't go into the technical, you now have a diagnosis where if you're grieving for somebody, if you lose someone to death, and let's just say you're a 80-year-old woman or man who loses his or her spouse after 50 years of a good marriage, and suddenly this person you depended on, this person who's one of the central figures in your life, is gone. And so, of course, you're very upset. Obviously, you'd be very upset. Well, the new DSM now allows you 2 weeks to recover from this grieving. So here's the thing. If you're still upset about your 50-year marriage being ended by death, after 3 weeks or a month, you're mentally ill and you should be put on psychiatric drugs. Think about that. Just think about that. It would apply to almost everyone who's older and loses a loved one. What are we allowing to happen here? I think, you know, you have to look at it. The psychiatrists are basically saying, and this is not really an exaggeration at all, I know, although I think it might be hard for some people to hear, but I think you should take a look at the proposed DSM. They're basically saying that virtually everyone in this country can be labeled as mentally ill with the most simple, you know, two-year-olds having tantrums, somebody losing their wife or husband. This is like ordinary, these are ordinary experiences of life, and an organized psychiatry, most psychiatrists are saying this is mental illness, and there's only one treatment for all these things, drugs, drugs, and drugs. And I've seen figures that at least 40% of all doctors, I can't speak for psychiatrists, but it's probably higher, but 30 or 40% of all doctors in this country are now taking drug company money to prescribe their products. How long can this society go on this way? This is a real threat to our society. It's not just a few, you know, crazy people like me that you can dismiss, although if you met me and I didn't tell you about my past, you wouldn't know about it. But I talk about my past because I think I have an obligation to other people who went through what I did to fight this. But if you think that this only applies to these people walking the streets talking to themselves, you're absolutely wrong. You're absolutely wrong, because psychiatry is now deciding that virtually with this new DSM, which is going to go into effect just days before the next APA convention in San Francisco in next May, it's going to go into effect. And in that DSM, virtually everyone in this country can find a diagnosis for them. There's just the most ordinary behaviors, ordinary emotions. It's basically, in a way, psychiatry is declaring that ordinary human emotions are mental illness. Is this the kind of society we want? Is this the kind of behavior that we should ignore because this is threatening to everyone? Do we want an America where everyone's going around zoned out on psychiatric drugs? We're really getting there. If one out of six or one out of five people are taking psychiatric drugs now, but 80 to 90 or maybe even 100% of people can be diagnosed as an excuse to give them psychiatric drugs, if we don't stop this, what are we looking at in a couple of decades? Everybody in the United States will be wandering around like a zombie. That your duty as a citizen consists of buying things and taking drugs. Is that what we want? What kind of country is that going to be? So I think, you know, I suppose people listening to the Peter Bregan show already have a consciousness about this, and I wish we were reaching people who don't ordinarily listen to courageous psychiatrists like Dr. Bregan who take on these abuses. But I think people should give this a lot of thought. It threatens everyone, not just people like me who got a label when I was six. It threatens everyone because once you get the label, then you get the drugs, and that's dangerous to everyone. I'm going to stop for breath again, Peter, so you can comment here.
Well, I've been really happy not to interrupt. I think that may be actually one of the longest times I've gone without interruption on the show, because I think that it's just so important to hear from you. It's just incredibly important to hear from you. And, you know, we don't really know how many people are on these drugs. I mean, there are estimates that women, the majority of women, that well over 20% of them are on just antidepressants. And if we started then adding in sleeping pills, pills for anxiety, all these antipsychotics being given out for stress and other things, we don't really know. But I suspect it's considerably more than 25 or 30% of women, and also a very large percentage of men. And the same thing with children. We get figures that 12% of adolescent boys are on stimulant drugs, for example. First of all, mostly these figures undercut the actual numbers. But what about all the other drugs these kids are taking? And what about all the kids who are on them for a while and then off them at the time of the survey? I just think we're thinking that the numbers here are much larger than the usual estimates. You're giving, when you say a fifth, you're giving the usual conservative estimate. And I And I think you're right. I think we're in a pandemic of psychiatric drugging. And, you know, it does so many bad things to children. It bathes their brains in toxic substances while they're growing. It convinces them while and remember, the brain is really growing. Like, some cells are dying back, other cells are growing more in response to the environment and usage. You know, millions of new connections are being made. And while you're doing that, you're bathing the drug in chemicals that influence and change how these neurons are connecting and how many connections they're making and how healthy the neurons are or aren't, because all these drugs are toxic to neurons. Then you have the moral effect on the children, which is convincing the children that, A, there's something the matter with them, that, B, they can't reach their full potential, and worst of all, that they can't take charge of their own lives, that there's a problem in their brain, and that's a lie, that there's a problem in their brain that prohibits them from taking charge of their lives.
Yeah, I want to jump in here and say that one of the worst things that happens to people, and I certainly experienced this, but I think these kids that just have been drugged as outpatients, you just lose your sense of self-esteem. You know, and I think Peter was starting to touch on that. You just lose a sense that you're a valuable person. You're just a drug consumer. I'd like to talk also
We're going to go to break in just about now.
Okay.
For a few minutes, and you'll be listening into the break. But my guest today is Ted Chapasinski. And you can Google Ted. He's on the internet. You can find him on all the various sources of information. When we come back, he can tell you more about getting in touch with him. Ted is a heroic figure in the movement of people abused who have been fighting back against psychiatry. It's just such a pleasure to have Ted on. We'll come back to him after the break.
You are listening to the Dr. Peter Bragan Hour on the Progressive Radio Network. Stay tuned, stay in touch, and call in with your questions at 888-874-4888. That's 888-874-4888.
And I'm returning to my guest, attorney, psychiatric survivor, Ted Chapasinski. Let me spell his name for you slowly. Chabasinski. Chapasinski.
Right.
I think I'll call the show Unleashing Ted Chapasinski. I'm just letting you run with what you have to say, and it's marvelous. I'm glad that there's a lot of focus on children, because like you, I'm just outraged by what's happening to our kids and to the children and what it also means to the future of the country. We can keep on that subject or go anywhere you would like. So I'm going to just give you the mic back with this, the first suggestion to tell people the best way to get in touch with you.
Okay. Well, I was thinking about giving my actual email address, but I think maybe I got a little more privacy. I have a Facebook page, and you can contact me on Facebook. And I'm actually not really hard to find anyway. If you Google me, you're going to find my email address in there somewhere. But I'd rather not give it out. It's easier for me. So it gives a little more distance on Facebook. So I'm Ted Chapasinski. I'm on Facebook. I wanted to say a little something about this whole thing about depression, because I think that's an amazing thing that's happened in the last, let's say, 20 or 30 years. Because I don't think we will label, you know, there's lots of sadness in life. There's this kind of idea in American culture that everybody's supposed to be happy. You know, you see all the ads with smiling people. Well, you know, that's not what life is like. Even a very good life is going to have moments of sadness. So this is probably the most basic, you know, conversion of ordinary human emotion into mental illness. So now nobody even says they're sad anymore. They say they're depressed. And when you say you're sad, you know, you're talking about you have a certain emotion. But when you say you're depressed, You're almost admitting to a mental illness. And this concept now, this concept that this is a kind of a mental illness or a chemical imbalance, which, by the way, the psychiatrists actually, the organized psychiatry has admitted this chemical imbalance theory is nonsense. But whatever it is, it's supposed to be pathological. You know, in the whole history of humankind, people have been, you know, upset and sad sometimes. That's just part of life. And if you're unhappy, there's almost always a reason for it. Although I don't deny there's a few people that have what used to be called endogenous depression, where it really was coming from something inside you. But for the overwhelming number of people, they're sad. They're sad because there's a reason. I mean, let's say your typical, your typical candidate for shock treatment, which is frequently now given for depression. Let's say this is a middle-aged to older woman in the suburbs. Her husband pays no attention to her. He's sleeping with his secretary. Her kids are grown and out of the home and don't treat her with very much respect. Well, if I was in that situation, I'd feel pretty bummed out, too. And I try to do something about it. And that's what's happening with this. Instead of people dealing with these ordinary human emotions like sadness and trying to figure out, what can I do about this? What can I do about this to change my life or to even change the people around me that are making me unhappy? But no, they say, I got to go to a doctor and take this pill. I had a very interesting experience quite about 20 or 30 years ago. I was in contact with this psychiatrist. His name was David Richman. He's still around, very anti-drug. And I was going through a terrible time in my life, just terrible. I actually wasn't sadness so much. It was like I was feeling like I was actually going crazy. And so I said to David, this is terrible. You know, I really need some help. Just give me the strongest drug you can because I'm just losing my mind here. And he said, just what I'm saying now, he said, I'm not going to give you any drug. You have to figure out what's wrong. And you know what? When I didn't have that option, of course I could have seen some regular psychiatrist, but I wasn't crazy enough to do that because I might have found myself back on a psych ward. But since I didn't have that easy option, I sat down. I thought, now what on earth is causing this? And you know what? It took me about 2 days to figure it out. I was in a very bad situation with a certain group of people who are really very toxic to me. And as soon as I got out of that situation, I felt fine. Because instead of taking a pill, or even worse, getting shock treatment, instead of doing that, I just figured out what was wrong and did something about it. So you have this, you have people basically being taught to tolerate these things in their lives, you know, to just put up with them, to do nothing to change their circumstances, which also, I must say, are sometimes larger than just a personal situation. I mean, if you're poor and unemployed and all that, you know, you need to try to do something about that, too. And now I want to, since Peter's giving me a free rein here.
I want to respond a little bit. Let him respond a little. Well, I have our first disagreement.
Really?
That is, endogenous depression was a hoax. There's no known internal defect in people that leads to depression. Now, there are real diseases that will wear you down. I mean, if you have Cushing's, or if you have diabetes, or if you're suffering from a systemic viral infection, or if your thyroid's not functioning, you'll get exhausted, you'll get worn out, and by golly, you may just get depressed because the imbalance, the difficulties in your body are causing your brain and yourself not to function very well. But those are actual diseases that we know that, just like a blow on the head, if it's hard enough, can lead you to feel depressed. Endogenous depression was a sexist, patriarchal concept invented to say that women going through the menopausal years had some deterioration inside them that was causing them to be depressed. When, Ted, you just did such a very good job of describing the kinds of issues that women do have to deal with. And I want to underscore the other thing that you're saying, which is, and put it in a slightly different way that I'm sure you'll agree with, that getting depressed and even getting suicidal is actually an opportunity to find out what really matters in your life. So when somebody comes to me and they're feeling that depressed, I don't say, well, that's terrible, let's get rid of your feelings. I say, basically, you know, that's a good thing that you're having all these feelings. It's good, because the extent to which that you are so despairing and down on life indicates that you have a vision of a better life. So let's see why you're getting down this time in your life, and let's see what it is that your next move is to make your life better than ever. And that is literally how I approach people with depression. It's an opportunity. And then just one other thought, because you just brought up all kinds of important and interesting things. This is going to be hard for some of our listeners to really believe. But we had all of this is about drug company marketing. In the 50s and 60s, when the big drive was marketing Valium and Xanax and Meprobamate and all these other benzos and other sedative drugs, that was the age of anxiety. Everybody had anxiety. And women in particular, instead of 20% or 25% being on SSRI antidepressants, even probably larger numbers were taking Valium. It was mother's little helper. Well, that market began to get old and tired, and along came the SSRIs for depression. So the marketing of depression became the key, and people stopped so much thinking about themselves as anxious. They started thinking of themselves more and more as depressed. So marketing just examines, looks at human nature and what do people go through, and says, well, we'll appeal to this, we'll appeal to that, we'll define this as an illness, we'll define that as an illness. It's that cynical. And with that, I give the mic back to you.
Well, I totally agree with you, Peter, about all this is driven by drug company marketing. There's no doubt about it. All this stuff about converting sadness into depression. Sadness now becomes a mental illness, because if it's a mental illness, you're going to take a drug for it. And I think your approach, I'm not a therapist, not really into alternatives either, although I think they're very important. But I think it's a very interesting concept, and I think you're right that sadness can be an opportunity, that if you find yourself bogged down in your life, it's a time to figure out, what is it that I want that I'm not getting? But I want to move to something else, which is not usually talked about on programs like this, which is, you know, we have a survivors movement, and there's been for a long time a movement of progressive, you know, conscientious mental health professionals like Peter to fight, you know, psychiatric abuse. But the survivor part has really come under attack in the last 25 years. And what's basically happened, we used to have a very independent movement. We didn't get money from anyone, which, of course, that's not the greatest thing either. But we did a lot of things, like the vote to ban shock treatment that Peter described that I was involved in, which the real effect of it, I think, in spite of the fact that the APA managed to get it struck down, it created a sensation among the general public, because my idea, my thought when I started to do it was, this is a way to get people to start looking at psychiatry and see how abusive it is. And I think that's what happened. And that led, I think, to what we saw a few years later, where the NIMH and now the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration, also called SAMHSA, basically bought off our movement, or at least most of it. They have an annual conference called Alternatives every year. It's totally funded by now, SAMHSA. There are many people getting funding from them who have weird sort of things. They call them technical assistance centers, whatever that is. They have people being trained as what's called peer something or other, peer specialists. It's basically providing cheap labor for the mental health system. And what it basically has done is you don't see votes to ban shock treatment. You don't see too many demonstrations anymore, with the exception of a few bright spots in this country, like in New York. What you see is a whole bunch of people taking handouts from the mental health system and not really doing anything to change it. And I think there's no place in a democratic society for this. I think this is something people should be concerned about, too. It's not the business of the government to choose our leaders. You know, in Italy in the 1930s, and the Fascist Party chose the leaders of different segments of civil society. They decided who would represent women. They decided who would represent labor. They decided who would represent this group and that group. And those are the people they would deal with. And, of course, the people they dealt with were just doing and saying what the fascist government wanted them to say. Now, I know I'll be accused of exaggeration and all that, but this is fascism. This is what the fascists did. They chose the leaders of these different groups, and that's what the government, the federal government's mental health agency, SAMHSA, is doing now. They're choosing who our leaders are. They're using, they're misusing public funds to make sure that our movement doesn't do anything that's going to threaten their power. A few years ago, one of the groups that you got money to have one of these conferences invited Bob Whitaker on, and I have to say that Bob, you know, he's an honest journalist whose book on psychiatric drugs is very important. You know, and he reviews the research that shows how damaging it is. Okay, they invited him, and SAMHSA said he wasn't going to be invited. It was just as simple as that. And what does that tell you? What are they promoting? They're drug pushers, just like the American Psychiatric Association is. And so this is not – these. They can do this. We can't stop them, but they have no business misusing – this is a misuse of public funds. I don't know how many times I can say it here. It's a misuse of public funds, and they should be stopped from doing this. They're not, this is not, should not be their purview. If they want to promote drugs, we have to fight that too. But for them to say they're going to decide who they're, who the leaders of the movement that's supposed to be fighting them are going to be, this is like outrageous. And it's also, it's like 1984. I know that, for instance, there's a conference, one of these conferences is going to take place in Portland next month, and they're going to, and the theme is supposed to be honoring our past and building our future. And I know what they're going to say about our past because they've done it before. The very same people made the same kind of presentation. And they're going to say that our movement was doing nothing, nothing at all. We were just huddling together for warmth or something like that until the marvelous, you know, federal mental health people came in and helped us see the light. Well, I wrote an article for Mad in America, the website Mad in America, that I would really recommend your readers look at, because I was involved in this movement for, I've been involved in this movement for many years, and I kind of laid out what we'd actually done. And I don't think, and again, I guess I'm bragging a little bit, but I don't think that our ability to make, you know, a whole city vote against shock treatment shows that our movement didn't amount to anything until the federal mental health system took it over. I mean, basically, they took it over because we were being so effective. And I think people that are concerned about that say, what a right to their congresspeople. And I must say also that I think it's, you know, I'm a pretty left-wing person, but I have to give credit to people like Senator Grassley, who's a conservative Republican from Iowa, because he's really done a lot to expose this. He was the one that forced Biederman to force the drug companies actually to admit to the money they were handing out. So I think if this is not an issue that should really be conservative or liberal, this is an issue that should concern anybody who wants our society to be democratic. Your tax money should not be used to smash legitimate movements like ours. These people should not be allowed to do this. And I think those of you who are into, you know, writing letters to your congresspeople, this is a good issue to write to them about. And if you want to hear more about it from me, you can find my article on madinamerica.com. Or just write to me, and I'll be glad to correspond with anybody who wants to get involved with this, because it's been we could have saved literally hundreds of thousands of lives, hundreds of thousands of people we could have protected from this heavy drugging, hundreds of thousands of children we could have protected from the abuses that they're experiencing now in the last 25 years. And instead, we got some people allowed themselves, I certainly would never take their money, but some people allowed themselves, they just took the money, they built little bureaucracies for themselves. I don't want to name names, but I think a lot of people active in our movement know exactly who I'm talking about. There's always corrupt people. There's always opportunists who will do this. But I don't think this country, I think this is just doesn't have any place in a democratic society. So please contact me if you're interested in this, and I'll tell you more, or I'll suggest who I think you could write to. And I think I'll stop talking again and let Peter comment on this.
Well, I'm ready to applaud. I haven't applauded on the show before.
Well, thank you, Peter.
I just think everything you're saying is so important. You know, when I first started being an activist, it was around stopping lobotomy. And in those days, I worked very closely with Congress, and I worked with liberals and people really as far left in Congress as there were in the Black Caucus.
Oh, yeah.
Because they were concerned that little Black children were being surgically mutilated as young as age 5 at the University of Mississippi in Jackson, and that there had been talk about how Black leaders in the riots and the uprisings, you know, had brain disease and should be operated on. I kid you not. All of this is in my book, and Ginger's book, The War Against Children of Color. But I also worked with conservatives, actually met my first conservative politicians, who in face-to-face conversations with me were won over to the belief that damaging the brain was immoral, that it was wrong. And I remember Senator Bell, from whose constituents included the National Institute of Mental Health in Maryland, siding with me and helping me write legislation trying to stop the federal funding of psychosurgery. So I'm so glad to hear you say this is not a left and it's not a right. There are good people on both sides that are standing up on these issues at times. And there are people on both sides that are very supportive of the drug companies, supportive of the drug companies. So I think that's incredibly important. And I want to agree with you that the survivor movement, the ex-inmate movement, whatever name we give it or that they adopt, is very vital in the early years. I worked very closely with people like yourself and Leonard Frank and just Judy Chamberlain and really Ray Unziker and on and worked very closely with them around the lobotomy campaign I was conducting, then about electroshock, which we were all joined together. And I haven't done much in recent years. It's one reason why I'm glad to have you on the show and to get you know, more involved with some key people here. And I agree with you 100% in what you're saying about SAMHSA buying a leadership so that these people don't take the kinds of stands that would lose them their federal money and their hope of federal jobs someday. I mean, it's that straightforward.
You're right on target there, Peter. And I have to say, I really appreciate your support over the years. When I was like just getting into the movement myself, I would hear you on the radio in New York, and you were talking about, you know, psychosurgery, and I thought this guy, he's not going to be a psychiatrist for very long if he keeps talking like this.
Well, they tried to get rid of me, but they failed, and in the process strengthened me. But you were certainly right about the attempts to stop me.
You know, this is a political movement. I mean, we talk about, I mean, Peter, the stuff you've written is really very valuable, but I think ultimately in a democratic society, you know, we have to influence the actual government, not these people like SAMHSA. But, you know, I think a lot of honest legislators on both sides, for instance, if we're spending money on trying to help people with their emotional problems, I think they would much rather spend it on something that's effective rather than on something that damages people. But it's our job to show them that that's the case. So I think it's very important for us to focus on that. And, of course, that's the very last thing SAMHSA wants to see. And I think also our movement generally, and again, I think this is because of SAMHSA, they don't talk to the general public. They just talk to, guess who, SAMHSA. And so we have to be out there talking to the general public, because that's what you do in a democratic society. You have to win people over to your point of view, but you're not going to do it if you're basically become a branch of the mental health system, which is what SAMHSA has managed to accomplish. But I think there are pockets of resistance here. Oh, and it gives me a chance to announce something. There's a lot of people in New York State that are really great. There's some, I hate to single somebody up, there's this great new leader, Daniel Hazen. I just want to get his name in. And there's going to be a demonstration on October 6th in New York City, starting at noon near the UN building and marching to a hotel in Midtown where the American Psychiatric Association is having a smaller convention. It's going to be Saturday, October 6th. It's going to start at about noon across the street from the UN building. And I would urge any of the listeners here to come to that demonstration. I think it's going to be very important. I'm hoping there's going to be some good press coverage. I'm going to be there speaking. A lot of other good people are going to be speaking. And this is the kind of thing we need to be doing, not to be applying for funds to run some little mental health bureaucracy of our own. I'm not interested in running a mental health bureaucracy. I am interested in promoting decent kinds of people do need help. I mean, when they say if you're against psychiatry, what are you going to replace it with? And I think we do need to replace it with something positive. If, you know, really conscientious therapists and doctors like you, Peter, and there's a lot of others. There's your group, and there's another group, two nationwide groups of progressive, you know, of conscientious mental health professionals. And there's a lot of people in the survivor movement who want to work on alternatives, and they have, you know, peer respite places where people can go instead of putting themselves in the psych ward. There's now a move to the state of Vermont, amazingly enough, has now budgeted $1 million a year for something called Soteria House, which it might take a little time to. This happened. We're running out of time, aren't we? Well, it's a place where people
can go. Yeah, we got about, I'd say, a minute and a half to go.
Okay, it's a place where people can go and not get drugged. They're just allowed to go through their upsetness without being drugged, just with emotional support. And I benefited from something like that 30 years ago that was then happening in Vancouver, Canada, and it really saved my life. And that would replace people just being locked up in psych wards and started on a lifetime of drugs. And this is the sort of thing we ought to be doing, but you can bet.
Now, Ted, has that money in Nevada actually been allocated
Vermont
for Soteria House, or are people going to have to compete to get money?
My understanding is the state of Vermont has made massive.
Oh, it's Vermont, right? Yes, go ahead.
Yeah, well, and then there's some guy named Stephen. God, his name escapes me right now.
Okay. Well, we're coming to the end.
Okay.
Ted Chapasinski, a friend from decades ago. So good to renew the friendship and to work together again. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Peter.
You've been listening to the Dr. Peter Bragan Hour with a new live show every Monday evening at 5 p.m. East Coast time on the Progressive Radio Network, where each show is archived for your convenience. You can learn more about Dr. Bragan and his lifelong reform work on www.bragan.com. That's B-R-E-G-G-I-N.com.